Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hey everyone, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets in the car, while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And today we're going to be talking about broadly, a topic that we've touched on a number of times here before, and that is immortality. We've touched on it in terms of religion and mythology. We've touched on it from the standpoint of our great fear of mortality and death, and therefore our longing for immortality in basically every aspect of our lives. And we have also talked about it a little bit in terms of improving human longevity.
And I'm sure we've talked about it a good bit in reference to Highlander because Robert, you've been watching that movie for about 35 years, I think, since you started it in like 3-second increments or something.
Yeah, I'm watching it on a streaming service in 5 to 10 minute sections. It's a race against time to see if I can finish Highlander before it's removed from this particular streaming service.
You know what they call that kind of lunch break?
What?
It's the quickening.
I tend to call it a squat and gobble because you're just kind of like squatting in your living room, just eating as fast as possible and watching just a little bit of Highlander and then going back to work.
Now, how does the Highlander version of immortality stack up against all the normal kinds of immortality you find in mythology and religion?
I think you would probably agree with me that it's not the deepest treatment of immortality and mortality in our collective storytelling.
Yeah.
But it does hit on some of the main points, right? Like, oh, immortality sounds great, but then when you actually have to do it, it's kind of a pain.
Mm-hmm. I'd say a lot of religious visions are actually like that. They tell you, that a lot of religions include some version of immortality, whether it's a sort of linear survival after death of the soul, or there's a kind of eternal cycle of reincarnation or something like that. In any event, it very often is not necessarily encouraged for you to look too closely at the details of immortality.
Right. But the Highlander is essentially another version of the wandering immortal story where they're kind of stuck with it. What seems like it would be a blessing is kind of a curse. I feel like human perceptions of immortality, they tend to break down to this. imagined things that would normally terminate or undergo a phase shift but magically don't have to. So the desire for immortality is often either a reaction to just the reality of death and mortality itself, which is very understandable. It kind of defines our existence as modern humans. Or it comes from a desire for a certain state of existence to continue unchanged. But it does often kind of come back to this idea of stagnation, mm-hmm. you know? Like the thing I want is really stagnation. The thing I'm afraid of is change. I wonder if that's what we see in Highlander, you know, in these characters like Connor McLeod and Ramirez. You know, does Connor change? Is he changed by his experience in the film? I mean, certainly the Kurgan, the villain, isn't. Mm-hmm. It seems like it would be more interesting if you like switched around backgrounds and had like the goody two shoes becomes the villain and the ancient villain becomes the modern hero, that sort of transformation. But instead, these are very stagnant characters.
Well, it's actually part of the ancient mythological tradition of immortality that if it comes with too much change, it's actually a curse rather than a blessing. Think about Eos and Tithonus in Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. We've talked about them recently, where the idea is Eos, the goddess of dawn, has this lover, this mortal human lover named Tithonus, and she wants him to be able to live forever. So she cries to Zeus and says, please grant him immortality. And Zeus, being the jerk that he is, says, okay, done. Makes Tithonus an immortal, but doesn't grant him eternal youth. So he's going to live forever, but he's just going to get older and older. And that seems to be implied to be a fate worse than death.
Yeah. Another treatment on this that I really like, Richard K. Morgan in his book Altered Carbon, and also in the Netflix series that just recently came out that is basically that first book brought to life on the screen. Mm-hmm. In this show, you have essentially immortality via digital consciousness, digitized human consciousness moved from body to body. And typically, you have a very grim vision of what that would mean. It basically means that the worst, richest, decrepit individuals in society, they're just going to grow more and more awful because they have more – they have an increased lifespan in which to be awful and become jaded to their various inappropriate pleasures.
Yeah, we have a concept that the elderly tend to become wise in their old age. I mean, who knows if that's actually true, but there's at least an impression along those lines. But it seems to be premised on the knowledge that death is coming. What if wisdom is contingent on that?
Yeah, it takes me back to our episode on Chinese immortality and some of these Taoist concepts of like the elder enlightened being, mm-hmm. where your aging is a transformation into a different state. But so many of these ideas of immortality, it's like, yeah, you get to remain young forever. Forget without really thinking about what that would do, how that might warp the individual.
But what if there was a concept of immortality that in fact didn't imply any of these changes, right? It didn't say that you're going to make a phase transition to another kind of being. It didn't say that your soul's going to leave your body. It didn't say any of that. It was just a literal, physical, straightforward statement that everything's going to be normal. There's no magic except you'll just happen to never die.
Well, it sounds good. Is there a catch?
Whether or not it sounds good, this is what we want to talk about today, a physical possibility of immortality presented as a thought experiment with a lot of perhaps flawed underlying assumptions. So you're unfortunately not going to walk away from today's episode probably with the assumption that, yes, all humans will live forever based on the laws of physics. But we do want to explore that as a possibility.
Yeah. Nothing we're going to talk about here today is actually going to impact your life, except in the way maybe you think about your existence.
Quite true. Unless it does impact your life, in which case this is going to be very important.
We're barely talking about quantum mechanics and it's already tangled up in a knot here.
Right. So we should make the transition to talking about physics because this is going to be a physics-based episode talking about interpretations of quantum mechanics. And so I guess we should begin with just a little bit of the discussion of weirdness of scale. If you listen to this podcast, you've probably heard at least a little bit about the deep strangeness of physics at scales much bigger or smaller than the energy, mass, distance, speed and so forth that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. On, for example, vast scales, we live in a universe apparently dominated by dark matter, these gigantic gravitational anomalies that can't be seen or touched except by the way that they bend space-time and hold galaxies together. And on these huge scales, the dominating physics regime, the kind of physics that makes the biggest difference, is not the kind of physics that governs our everyday lives, but of Einstein's general relativity, where time is not a universal measure and can appear to slow down or speed up from different vantage points, where mass changes the geometry of space-time itself and can warp or even trap light itself. Now, shrink down to roughly human-sized scales, and suddenly the laws of physics appear to change. They don't really change, but different physical phenomena become the most salient, become the most important types of calculations to do when you're trying to figure out how things are moving and how one physical thing is affecting another. So at this normal scale, general relativity doesn't matter very much. We can throw baseballs and shoot cannons and smash watermelons and all that stuff without taking general relativity into the equation. And this scale is generally best described by Isaac Newton's classical mechanics. This is also the realm at which physics is intuitive, right? At this scale, everything seems to fly and fall and push and resist in a way that makes sense to us.
Yeah, this is the realm in which we have evolved to thrive.
Exactly. That's the important point. It's kind of hard to remember this, but we should do our best to internalize the fact that this middle scale of physics, the Newtonian scale, does not actually make any more sense in an objective point of view than the other scales do. It's just the scale at which our brains evolved. So presumably, if we happen to be evolved star-sized organisms, things like general relativity would be intuitive and would make natural sense to us, and Newtonian physics would be crazy, weird stuff that goes on down there.
One way that I like to think about it is the explanation that you can think of classical physics as the Earth's crust and quantum physics as the underlying mantle. And then you have to keep in mind that there are things about Earth's mantle that only make sense if you take into account Earth's inner core.
I think that's a good analogy, because if we do keep zooming down, we of course get to what you just mentioned, quantum mechanics, this next realm where things change yet again. You get to extremely small scales on the scale of elementary particles and tiny objects like atoms, protons, electrons, photons of light. And at this scale, the physics regime changes so that things stop behaving in a way best described by either general relativity or classical mechanics, and they instead behave according to a theory we now know as quantum mechanics or quantum physics. And this came about because, you know, originally, say at the dawn of the 20th century, scientists were trying to figure out how things like atoms could behave as reconciled by classical mechanics. They were trying to look at things like the orbit of electrons around the nucleus of an atom and say, okay, does that work in a classical mechanics way, like the way planets orbit around a star? And it just didn't work. So they had to figure out what's actually going on here. And eventually they came up with the theory of quantum physics, which is now predicted mainly by what is called – I've been saying his name wrong my whole life, I think – the Schrödinger equation. I've been calling him Schrödinger.
Oh, I've been saying Schrödinger as well. I feel like I've heard Schrödinger from everybody.
Yeah, I think I've heard it. But yeah. I don't know. I think Schrödinger is – shredding. It's hard to even say. I want to go Schrödinger.
Schrödinger.
It's all because of Schrödinger's.
With a name like Schrödinger. It does. It sounds more wholesome than cats in boxes that are neither dead nor alive, or both dead and alive at the same time.
Yeah. So you'll probably hear us say it both ways in this podcast. I apologize for that, but there's going to be just no getting around it. I guess it depends on how the wave function collapses each time. But so anyway, it is named after the Austrian physicist Erwin Schrödinger. And Schrödinger derived the equation in the mid-1920s. And ever since then, it has been profoundly useful and profoundly confusing. And this is because quantum mechanics is simultaneously one of the best, most predictive theories in all of science. And at the same time, it clearly implies a reality that makes absolutely no intuitive sense to us, mammals that evolved to deal with classical physics on the Newtonian scale. It is bonkers and completely defies our expectations of how the world should work. And there are a bunch of different ways you could explain this, but just to pick the simplest version for now, the Schrödinger equation can be used to predict the behavior of tiny particles like atoms and electrons over time. So just the way that you can use Newtonian equations to predict something like the arc of a cannonball or the force of a falling boulder, you can use the Schrödinger equation to predict the behavior of tiny particles like electrons or photons. But a Newtonian cannonball is experienced by us and described by physics as a single solitary object with one starting point, a single ending point, and a clear trajectory. A particle on the quantum scale does not behave that way at all, but rather, according to the Schrödinger equation, it behaves a lot like a pattern of waves in a fluid. And this means it can have what can seem like multiple contradictory properties. For example, a particle can, from our point of view, appear to have multiple different positions, velocities, or spin directions at the same time. And this range of possible simultaneous behaviors is what's known as the wave function. The wave function is all of these potentialities that seem to be simultaneously true about a quantum object or system. And this wave function exists in an abstract, infinite-dimensional space that's known as the Hilbert space. Now, again, of course, this makes no sense to us, but it's proven to a degree that's almost beyond dispute. Like, one of the most classic proofs of the wave function behavior of quantum scale objects is the double slit experiment.
Oh, yes. This is where we get the saying, when you're out of slit, you're out of peer, right? No, that's a different situation.
I don't know what you're talking
about. It's an old beer ad. Slits beer.
Schlitz beer.
Yeah.
We've actually just been looking at old beer ads here on the podcast.
Yeah.
There apparently was an old Miller ad that had gigantic monsters in it where they grab a truck full of Miller and just chug the truck.
Yeah. No, that one's awesome. I think that was from when I was a kid or in junior high or something. I remember seeing that one. The Schlitz beer ad where they have this whole, when you're out of Schlitz, you're out of peer. It's one I never actually saw, but was referenced on Mystery Science Theater 3000 growing up. So one of these many pop culture references that I have no direct experience with, only have secondhand experience with them from watching MST.
Isn't it sweet that all of these beer commercials are imprinted on your childhood?
Yeah. Well, some of them were not too bad. Some of them had monsters in them. But the double slit experiment, to get it back to quantum mechanics here, the basic idea is pretty simple. The experimenter shines a light on a barrier that has two narrow slits in it. And then the experimenter studies the interference pattern it produces on a screen.
So you've got like two walls in order, and the first wall that the light has to go through has the two slits, and then the back wall has a screen on it that the light can be projected on after it goes past the first wall.
Right. And I should also add that this was first performed by Thomas Young in 1801. Now, light has a dual nature. It's both wave-like and particle-like. In the experiment, light travels through both slits and creates this interference pattern. And if you send a single photon through, photon being the light particle.
Right, the single unit of electromagnetic energy.
So you send a single photon through, it still forms an interference pattern as if the single photon travels through both slits simultaneously.
If you hear me laughing, it's because at this point in our notes, Robert has inserted an image from the movie Time Cop.
Oh, yeah.
Two of what actor?
Ron Silver. Yeah, he played the villain. And here we have two different – the villain from different time periods encountering each other and kind of looking at each other with bemusement and or confusion. And I think both of these responses are apt when contemplating quantum mechanics. I mean, basically, though, this is a simple experiment to observe something that should not be, at least as far as classical physics is concerned.
Yeah, the idea that at the quantum level, a single object can appear to inhabit multiple places at one time. It produces this wave-like effect when it should be more like, you know, we'd think on a classical level it'd be like a ball thrown at something. It's one object, but it's not. And you have to wonder, how can this be true? Like, objects in our experience never appear to be in more than one place at one time. A bagel does not behave like a wave pattern in which, you know, there are peaks and troughs at different locations, right? A bagel is just a single solid object that doesn't move unless you move it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we mentioned Time Cop in passing here, and I don't think a deep scientific reading of Time Cop is essential here. But this and other films do kind of get into this territory when you have the paradox, right, of the same character encountering themselves from a different time.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, anytime something that is, I mean, how can that be, right? Somebody is in two places at once.
Yeah, it's used in fiction because obviously it never happens on a macroscopic scale in mm-hmm. reality. So the contradiction here is between the fact that the Schrödinger equation is obviously correct and the fact that it predicts stuff that makes no sense and we never see. And so it's led to the need for what are called interpretations of quantum mechanics. Pretty much everybody accepts the underlying theory of quantum mechanics. You'd be a fool not to. It's incredibly experimentally verified and very predictive. But there's a lot of disagreement about what it means and how it actually connects to our experience of reality. So, Robert, you mentioned the dead cat in the box earlier.
Yes.
This is going to be a feature of what's been for a long time the leading interpretation of quantum mechanics. So you've got different interpretations. We're going to talk about two mainly today, but there have been actually a bunch of different interpretations. The two we're going to be focusing on are the Copenhagen interpretation and what we will later discuss as the mini worlds interpretation. But the Copenhagen interpretation was created in the 1920s by the physicists Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg. And the Copenhagen interpretation essentially postulates a world governed by quantum mechanical probabilities. And these probabilities get decided on through a process known as wave function collapse. So you've got these multiple possibilities at the same time. That's the wave function. And then they're going to say it collapses. So what does that mean? So imagine you've got a quantum level particle like an electron. And you're trying to figure out where's it going to be. Is the electron going to be on the right or is it going to be on the left? What the Copenhagen interpretation says is that this wave function is in a state of unresolved potential called superposition, and the electron could be on the right and it could be on the left. And in fact, it's neither one, but it's in this state where there's a 50% probability of each. And here's where it connects with our world of solid macroscopic objects that are in only one state and one place at a time. The Copenhagen interpretation says that the wave function collapses into only one of its potential configurations once somebody observes it. Now, this has led to a lot of people reading all kinds of crazy esoteric things about consciousness into quantum mechanics, right?
Right. Yeah. Basically, what is the role of the observer and everything?
Yeah. But I think a lot of those consciousness type ideas are based on a misinterpretation of the grounding of the Copenhagen interpretation and a misunderstanding of the fact that the Copenhagen interpretation is not a sure thing, that it is an interpretation, not the theory itself.
But this is where the cat comes in.
Yeah.
The idea that the cat is simultaneously dead and alive inside of this box where random life or death is going to occur.
Right. So, this is going to be how they map it up from the quantum realm into the macroscopic world.
Mm-hmm.
How does our reality connect with these probability distributions on the quantum level? So you've got an electron. It's neither on your left nor on your right, but in a state of superposition where there is simultaneously a 50% probability of finding it on each side if you look with precision. And it just stays this way, suspended with these possibilities until somebody observes it, meaning you use some kind of device or method to figure out exactly where that particle is. And then once somebody does that, then it's actually only in one place. It was in superposition. Then you looked at it. Now it's on your left.
It's not that crazy a situation to really wrap your head around if you sort of think of it in terms of like TV production or something. You know, if you're on
right.
One of these shows where you have to guess what's behind the curtain, and there's something behind each curtain, but only one curtain is actually going to be opened.
Oh, yeah, in a kind of solipsistic way. It's almost not hard to believe that the universe only matters when I look at it. So despite the fact that many physicists have felt fine relying on this interpretation for the decades since then, I mean, one thing we should point out is that you can do all kinds of useful quantum mechanics science and even use it for technology without knowing which interpretation is correct. And in fact, it sometimes doesn't matter which interpretation is correct. The math of the theory works either way, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But many continue to protest that the Copenhagen interpretation is nonsensical, and it leads to these apparent absurdities like, as you mentioned, Robert, the cat in the box, the famous Schrodinger's cat or Schrödinger's cat.
Yeah, we've already referenced it a couple of times. You should probably just lay it out for us here exactly how this experiment goes. However, you know, I do have a soft spot for cats.
Yeah, let's get rid of cats. I don't want to kill a cat again. People talk about killing cats way too much in science. Maybe they're anti-cat. I'm going to bring in a unicorn because we've established that maybe unicorns aren't as perfect as everybody thinks they are.
This particular experiment funded entirely by Tim Curry, Lord of Darkness, by the way.
Full disclosure. Okay, so you've got a unicorn in a box. This box is totally opaque and nobody can see what's happening inside. There are no cameras inside. You don't know what's going on there. And there is a device inside the box that will instantaneously incinerate the unicorn if it's triggered. And the device gets triggered based on a quantum superposition event. So there's a particle that has a 50% chance of spinning clockwise and a 50% chance of spinning counterclockwise. And if when you check the particle, it's spinning clockwise, the unicorn dies. And if it's spinning counterclockwise, the unicorn lives. But this would mean that the unicorn is both literally alive and dead at the same time inside the box until somebody looks inside the box to observe what happened. And at the moment somebody looks inside the box, then suddenly the unicorn is actually just either alive or dead. But until somebody looked, it was both. Robert, do you think that describes the universe we live in?
I don't think it does not really describe the universe that we perceive. That's the thing.
Yeah.
The universe we live in is vast beyond our abilities to process it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's the answer is kind of yes and no at the same time.
I mean, I feel kind of again, we want to be clear that we think the universe does not need to adhere to our intuition. So just the fact that something seems unlikely to you or to me doesn't make it actually unlikely to exist in the world. But just going on a gut level, that one has come to feel less and less right to me. And so I'm kind of disposed against the Copenhagen interpretation, I think. All that means is that it doesn't necessarily feel right to me. That doesn't mean it's not true.
I feel like it lines up well with personal anxiety, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's essentially – because when you're anxious about the future, the bad things that can happen are as real as the good things or just the mediocre things that could happen. Mm-hmm. And the bad thing is only really gone when you actually reach the point where the particle has spun left, you know?
Uh-huh.
So there is something about this particular explanation that I think does match up with some of the ways we perceive our world.
Yeah, it definitely lines up with some emotional realities,
yeah.
But maybe less so with physical objects.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
We'll see. I mean, again, we can't rule it out. It's still been the interpretation that's been favored by the majority of physicists since the advent of quantum mechanics. But like we said earlier, it's not the only way. And to get to our discussion of physical immortality, we're going to have to explore another interpretation of quantum mechanics that arose in opposition to the Copenhagen interpretation. We will start looking at that when we get back from a break.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours.
Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O Allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gaginianaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
All right, we're back. So we're going to start talking here about the many worlds interpretation, which I believe we've probably touched on the show before, because it is one of these that spins off into very fantastic comic book realms, right? The idea of alternate realities, other worlds where other things have happened, essentially the Library of Babel.
Yes, but with a specific physical mechanism causing it to come into existence. Mm-hmm. And so we will do our best to try to explain this here. Now, we've been talking about the Copenhagen interpretation, the idea that you've got a quantum mechanical system that's in superposition. It's sort of both in a simple way, it's both left and right literally at the same time until you look at it, at which point it becomes just one or the other. And so observation causes the collapse of the wave function and it just becomes a normal physical reality, just like the kind of single solitary reality that we're used to looking at. Here's the main difference between that and what we're about to talk about, the many worlds interpretation. In this interpretation, a particle does not exist in superposition between two possible outcomes and then collapse into one outcome or the other when we look at it. Instead, it exists as a wave function in this superposition where there it has multiple different qualities at the same time. It's both left and right. It's in this state as a wave, and then it stays that way. And it just keeps staying that way. And that's how it works.
So in other words, the bad thing that ends up not happening actually does happen, but it's in essentially another timeline.
Yeah, pretty much. So this was first proposed by the physicist Hugh Everett III when he was a graduate student at Princeton in 1957. And it's not the core of the theory that there are multiple universes, but you cannot deny that when you take this theory to its logical conclusion, it puts us in a multiverse of infinite timelines.
Right. Infinite timelines, infinite parallel universes, each different from the last. Now, in some of these universes, it again comes right back to basically what we described in the Library of Babel. Mm-hmm. In some of these universes, the difference is going to be really slight, such as a parallel universe where everything is exactly the same except you had a bagel for breakfast instead of cereal. Then there's also one, for instance, there's a universe where Highlander won Best Picture at the 59th Academy Awards.
Well, no, I want to take issue with you there for a second. It predicts that you could possibly have every variation on the universe that is allowed by the laws of physics. I'm not sure if the laws of physics rule out a Highlander Best Picture win.
Well, there's papers will have to be written about that. So we'll have to see some peer-reviewed papers on that question, Joe. Basically, the idea, though, is for each possible outcome to a given action, the world splits into copies of itself, instantaneous processes that Everett calls decohesion. But before I move forward on the Oscars, I guess a better argument you could say that there's a version where that year the Academy Awards, Children of a Lesser God won as opposed to Platoon, which actually won.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so what it would actually mean is that the outcomes of these universes split every time there are different possible branches of a quantum superposition. Mm-hmm. Now, the question would be, how often are differences in reality determined by a quantum superposition going into its different possibilities?
Mm.
Presumably, the answer to that is a lot because, I mean, quantum mechanics underlies all kinds of stuff that's happening all the time. It underlies things that are happening inside people's brains. It underlies things that are happening in physical reality and the interactions between objects. Small random differences in how a quantum superposition event breaks off could lead to macroscopic effects down the line.
And some of these effects could be rather severe. So you could have other universes which would differ in ways that alter reality on a grand scale. For instance, imagine a parallel universe with no gravity. Some cosmologists use the theory as a handy explanation for why life evolved in our universe at all. Their answer is simply, well, there are countless universes where life never evolved and various universes in which it evolved along similar lines as ours. It's kind of a way to get around the Copernican principle, uh-huh. Right? The idea that Earth and therefore Earth life and the human experience should not have a privileged position in the cosmos.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's essentially that's sort of anthropic reasoning.
Yeah.
Right? The anthropic principle, like why do we live on a planet that's capable of supporting life? The idea under that is like, well, where would you expect to live? Would you expect to live on a planet that couldn't support life?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of interesting questions about whether that type of reasoning is valid or not. I used to read about this kind of stuff, but it's been a while since I did.
Well, it's like how is it possible that I'm alive and I haven't been killed by Jason Voorhees? Well, there are multiple alternate realities where I have.
Uh-huh.
But where else could I be thinking about this at this point in my life than a universe in which I have not?
Now, that kind of reasoning will come up again in a big way in a minute. So we should be clear that the existence of possibly infinite parallel universes is a consequence or an implication of Everett's interpretation of quantum mechanics, not the core assumption of it. The core assumption is just the universality of the wave function. It just says the wave function is real. All of the different possibilities of the wave function are real. They actually exist and they never collapse. But Everett believed that if you follow the logic, if you extrapolate that out to the macroscopic scale that we live on, the only way to make sense of it is that bifurcating realities constantly split off from one another and exist independently. And just a few interesting biographical notes. Everett recounted in the 1970s that the many worlds interpretation sprang up one night when he was talking with a couple of Princeton classmates about the implications of quantum mechanics. It was, quote, after a slosh or two of sherry. And that seems kind of right? Like the many worlds interpretation has got to be a sherry-based interpretation. It is like not a vodka-based interpretation, nor is it a beer-induced interpretation.
Yeah, it does. It does sound like the sherry is essential here.
Yeah, and another thing that's essential is the simplicity of it, right? The core selling point of the many worlds interpretation is that we've tested the mathematical reality of quantum theory. We pretty much know it's right. So what does the math say? Despite how outlandish the physical implications of the many worlds interpretation seem, you can make a pretty strong argument that it is the simplest possible interpretation of the math of quantum theory. If you just look at the mathematical features of the wave function and you try to take away all your intuitions about how things should work, it's the simplest possible way to make sense of it. And about it being the simplest theory, Everett actually wrote in a letter to the physicist Bryce DeWitt in 1957, quote, I do believe, however, that at this time the present theory, meaning the many worlds interpretation, is the simplest adequate interpretation. The hidden variable theories are, to me, more cumbersome and artificial, while the Copenhagen interpretation is hopelessly incomplete because of its a priori reliance on classical physics, excluding in principle any deduction of classical physics from quantum theory or any adequate investigation of the measuring process, as well as a philosophic monstrosity with a reality concept for the macroscopic world and a denial of the same for the microcosm. So that's kind of a strong argument he's saying, right? Like the Copenhagen interpretation says, oh yeah, the macroscopic world is real, but there's something about the quantum realm that isn't as real as our world is.
Yeah, it kind of relegates it to like a ghost realm.
Yeah. One of the books we're going to be referring to in this episode is Max Tegmark's 2014 book, Our Mathematical Universe. And Tegmark writes about DeWitt. He says, quote, "When I later met Bryce, he told me he'd at first complained to Hugh Everett, saying that he liked his math, but was really bothered by the gut feeling that he just didn't feel like he was constantly splitting into parallel versions of himself. He told me that Everett had responded with a question. Do you feel like you're orbiting the sun at 30 kilometers per second? Touché, Bryce had exclaimed and conceded defeat on the spot. Just as classical physics predicts that we're zooming around the sun and we won't feel it, Everett showed that collapse-free quantum physics predicts that we're splitting and that we won't feel it. Now, despite the fact that it does seem to make sense to a lot of people now, unfortunately, it did not catch on in Everett's lifetime when the Copenhagen interpretation remained dominant. And Everett was reportedly bitter about academia's rejection of his work. He left academic physics. He went to work at the Pentagon, where he was apparently involved in some Cold War nuclear strategy. And over time, friends and colleagues reported that he had a lot of bitterness and negative affect, and that he also struggled with alcoholism, and he eventually died pretty young. He died at the age of 51 in 1982. And just as a side note about his family, one of Everett's children is actually Mark Oliver Everett, who is the singer of the rock band called Eels.
Huh. Interesting. Well, it makes me wonder if he has any songs about his father.
Yeah, he apparently does, actually.
Oh, okay.
I haven't listened to them. I haven't listened to a lot of Eels, but I remember getting some mix CDs when I was in high school that had some Eels songs on
okay.
them.
Okay. Eels fans will have to chime in and let us know.
Yeah, let us know what we should listen to. But anyway, since Everett's death, the many worlds interpretation has gradually become much more popular, actually. The Polish-American physicist Wojciech Zurek has said, quote, "Everett's accomplishment was to insist that quantum theory should be universal, that there should not be a division of the universe into something which is a priori classical and something which is a priori quantum. He gave us all a ticket to use quantum theory the way we use it now to describe measurement as a whole." So essentially, it's a way of looking at quantum theory and saying, no, it's all real, it all works, it totally applies to the universe as a whole. It's not some weird special realm that we have to invoke strange types of causation to understand. But here's the question. If it's true that the wave function is real and universal, and its reality has effects that hold sway over the macroscopic world, the world we live in, what does this mean for us? What should it be like to be a person living within a mini-worlds universe?
Yeah, because it seems like, okay, it's one thing to say that every time I make a choice, the timeline splits, but I still feel like I am an object moving along a timeline. Even if I'm splitting, I have this singular experience, unless I'm bringing in some sort of religious idea of what my consciousness is doing in other lives.
Yeah, I mean, we can't have access to that, right?
Right.
And here's actually the question. Here is the really interesting question. Why don't we have access to that, right? What is actually happening in the physical realm? If the mini worlds interpretation is correct, what is actually happening that puts those in another place and keeps you separate from them? Which is essentially the same as saying, why does the wave function branch into separate realities? And the answer, as best I can tell, appears to lie in a quantum physics concept known as decoherence. Now, I mentioned earlier that Max Tegmark book, Our Mathematical Universe, and he has a pretty good discussion of decoherence in his book. But basically, the way it works is this. As long as a quantum system in superposition remains physically isolated, all of its potential states can continue to interact with one another. But systems, of course, almost never stay isolated for long. I mean, how often would you expect a system in reality to stay isolated from any contact with the outside? If even a single photon from the outside of the system interacts with it, then the system undergoes what's known as decoherence. We mentioned this concept earlier, which means that its potential states can no longer interact with each other. If they can no longer interact with each other, they essentially branch off. They become causally separate timelines, whereas before they were intertwined. So in a basic sense, imagine you've got an isolated quantum system where you've got a particle on the left and the right at the same time in superposition. But if anything touches it, decoherence happens, and then it splits into different branches of the universe that can no longer affect one another. Thus, the wave function does not collapse. Decoherence just prevents these branches from messing with each other anymore. Now, we teased at the beginning that this would be coming to the concept of immortality. How do you get immortality out of any of the physics concepts we've been discussing so far?
Well, I know the answer to this question, and I'm still not convinced that you do. But basically, you're going to have to pull out a thought experiment.
Yeah.
And you're going to have a machine. And as it seems to be just the running trend with quantum mechanics thought experiments, it's going to somehow involve lethal violence.
Yeah. One way this has been described, we're about to get to something known as the quantum suicide experiment. And one way this has been described is Schrödinger's cat from the cat's perspective. You make yourself the cat. So several physicists, apparently beginning with two independent lines of work by Hans Moravec and Bruno Machal in the 1980s, and then later by Max Tegmark, have proposed an apparently ingenious and perhaps flawed way to test whether the many worlds interpretation is correct and how that would affect personal subjective consciousness. We do not recommend this method at all. You should not try it out. But here's the method that's been described. You have to build a machine that will kill you.
All right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will assemble this machine or a version of this machine.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbionica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbionica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbionica.com. Symbiotica.com.
All right, we're back. So we've been discussing how the many worlds interpretation would affect the subjective experience of life and death. And there has been a type of experiment proposed by some physicists to test for the reality of the many worlds interpretation by experimenting with one's own life and death subjective experience. This is known as quantum suicide, or the quantum suicide experiment. Now, Robert, you have come up with a more fun version of this experiment than the usual one. The usual one involves creating some kind of gun that is designed to shoot you or not shoot you based on a quantum event.
Yeah, and this is Max Tegmark's concept, right? That, yeah. there's a machine gun in the original version.
Yeah, he's got the idea of a machine gun that that has a trigger pull that's initiated by a potential quantum superposition that could go one way or could go the other. Like, you've got a particle that could be spinning right and it could be spinning left, and it's got a 50% chance of being either one. And if you check it and it's spinning right, the gun fires. And if you check it and it's spinning left, the gun does not fire. And it does this once per second. And then he says, the test is you put your head in front of the gun.
Yeah, and that's just, I don't know. It just feels a little too violent for this podcast for some reason.
Yeah.
So I thought, yeah, let's try something maybe a little more science fiction-y in nature, a little less gun-centric, and maybe a little more Dune-inspired. So my apologies to Max for alterations here. Also, I guess, apologies to Frank Herbert as well, just in case. But this is how it's going to roll out. We're going to take you through the experiment. You're going to start with a man or a young man.
Oh, this is going to be Paul Atreides, right?
Essentially, yeah. You can essentially think of it as Paul Atreides. And he's going to sit before a machine, a non-thinking machine, mind you, that's designed to jab him in the arm with a metacyanide poison needle, a.k.a. a gom jabber, based on the spin of a quantum particle. So if that gom jabber hits
jabber.
It's going to be instant death. Just no chance.
Okay. And it is instant. He won't even know it happened.
Right. So the machine, again, is going to look at that quantum particle and study its spin. If there's a clockwise spin on the quantum particle, then the gob-jabber is going to strike.
Okay.
If there's a counterclockwise spin on the quantum particle, the gom-jabber just buzzes threateningly. The young man here keeps pushing the button, and the gom-jabber buzzes and buzzes, but it doesn't move. Each time he pushes the button, it buzzes, but it doesn't strike.
Well, yeah. So what's happening here in this experiment? As you can tell, the experiment has a probability-based outcome. After the first button push, there's a 50% chance that Paul will live and a 50% chance that he's going to die. And then this repeats. On the second try, there is a cumulative 25% chance that he'll live. And by the third try, half of that, and it just keeps going down until probability virtually guarantees that Paul Atreides has been struck dead by the gom jabber. But from Paul's own subjective point of view, this experiment actually might have a very different flavor, assuming – and there are some assumptions underlying this – assuming that consciousness ends immediately at death. Now, of course, if consciousness survives death, we're obviously in a whole different ballgame. But for Paul himself, there is only one option for Paul to discover after each push of the button. He discovers he has survived. If the gom jabber strikes and he's instantly killed, he will never be aware of it. But in a universe in which the many worlds interpretation is correct, there is no opportunity for him to be the one who dies, since his subjective experience of those branches of the wave function does not exist. So if Paul is anything, he can only be the version of himself that survives. And thus, if he starts performing this experiment, the only versions of him that exist to continue the experiment will be the ones that continually rout his consciousness into branches of the wave function in which he survives. So he'll just keep pressing the button over and over and over again, and the only thing he'll ever experience is survival.
And this will happen an infinite number of times.
If necessary, yeah.
Now, what are the drawbacks to this experiment?
Well, there are obviously theoretical objections to the validity of the experiment, reasons to think that even if the many worlds interpretation is correct, the experiment wouldn't actually work, and we can explore those in a moment. But on top of that, there are some big problems, like you have to be willing to kill yourself, And you can never use this test to prove the many worlds interpretation to people other than yourself. It's not actually a scientific experiment, because a scientific experiment needs to be able to be objectively verified. And this is an experiment that by necessity can only be subjectively verified. Even if it works as proposed, it would only be valuable to you yourself. The vast majority of people throughout the quantum multiverse watching you perform this experiment will just witness you killing yourself on the first try or the second try or the third try and so on. And each time you press the button, a greater proportion of the people watching you throughout the quantum multiverse will just be watching you kill yourself.
Plus, it's a perfect waste of a good gom jabber, in my opinion.
Yeah. Now, assuming for a moment that the logic of this experiment is valid, and there are potentially strong reasons for thinking it's not, but just go with this for a second. It gets weirder, because let's extend the reasoning beyond the confines of the experiment. Here are a few thoughts to consider. In any dangerous real-world situation that might lead to death, whether you maybe just got a blast of neutron radiation in the face or somebody tries to drop a garbage truck on you from a great height or whatever, there is always a small chance that something will happen to prevent you from dying. Would you agree, Robert? You with me so far?
Yeah, I would say broadly speaking, that's true.
It might be a very small chance, mm-hmm. but there's always a small chance,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Superman could appear and jump in front of the bullet, the train, et cetera.
Well, okay, maybe not that, because we don't want to violate the laws of physics. So there's always a small chance that without violating the laws of physics, something will happen to prevent you from dying in this scenario.
Right, there's always some sort of freak occurrence that could prevent it from happening, yes.
Yes. So if there's a chance of survival that's consistent with the laws of physics, there's at least some branch of the universal wave function in which that chance becomes reality. So at some level, all threats to survival are quantum threats. And thus, if on these assumptions, if the many worlds interpretation is correct, you should always expect to continue surviving, no matter how improbable the odds, because subjectively, you have no choice but to survive. If there is anything that you are the version of you that has survived. And so the vast majority of the versions of you throughout this quantum multiverse will die, but the subjective version of you will always live on in the branches of reality that break in favor of your survival. Now, again, just to clarify, we're not advocating this as necessarily the truth about reality. But if you consider this is a possibility, it is very strange to contemplate, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is, though, I always wonder with stuff like this, are we really talking about immortality here or just a mere thought experiment variant that's kind of worthless when you really think about it, you know?
Well, what do you mean by that?
I mean, well, simply, for one thing, it doesn't match up with those magical ideas of being forever young, of living your life across the span of centuries, et cetera. It's more about narrowly avoiding death as long as possible, and there's a fixed term limit there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could imagine that this is the quantum mechanics version of being Tithonus, right?
Yeah.
That you essentially, in pretty much all universes, decline as normally the laws of physics would dictate into a state where you are no longer in good health or whatever, but things just keep preventing you subjectively from dying, right? And that in most universes, you would keep dying. You just subjectively would never experience it because you just keep getting funneled more and more into that smaller minority of universes where you go on.
Now, according to Everett biographer Keith Lynch, quote, Everett firmly believed that his many worlds theory guaranteed him immortality. His consciousness, he argued, is bound at each branching to follow whatever path does not lead to death.
That's interesting. So, and especially it's strange since Everett died so young.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's interesting to come back to Dune. I feel like that, weirdly enough, this is exactly the sort of thing that's touched on in Frank Herbert's Dune, the idea that humanity should take this golden path instead of the path to stagnation, which is chosen by taking the safest route, by always making the safest small choice instead of figuring out what is the ideal long-term route.
Well, does this play into the choice to take spice in the Dune universe? Because in the Dune universe, Frank Herbert wrote that, you know, one of the main uses of spice, this stuff that's produced by the makers, is that it prolongs life, right? It's the geriatric spice.
That's true, yeah. But then it's also, you see its use with the Spacing Guild,
yeah,
where the idea is if the Spacing Guild has their way, you know, they're just going to always – I mean, they navigate space by figuring out how – what path avoids every possible catastrophe. And it's kind of like the quantum immortality model here, except of space travel. There's a quote to this effect from Maud Deeb in Frank Herbert's Dune. Quote, "The vision of time is broad, but when you pass through it, time becomes a narrow door. And always he fought the temptation to choose a clear, safe course, warning that path leads ever down into stagnation."
Well, yeah, if you look at life as sort of – you always have to take a risk in order to do something meaningful, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's very rarely a thing you can do that's very powerful and meaningful that doesn't risk at least some small part of your at least sense of safety, right?
Yeah.
That might just be psychological safety. But if you extend that to the extreme, would you – become in this quantum multiverse in the many worlds interpretation a progressively more boring person because you're always being limited to the options of your life that are always narrowing into this window of worlds where you've taken the safer route. And the versions of you that took the more dangerous route and took risks didn't make it as far.
Yeah, you can only lead to stagnation that way. Like the only way to lead the golden path is that all other paths were platinum.
Right.
Which is kind of a depressing way to think about life.
But this is a strange thing because it doesn't even give you the opportunity. If you were to assume that the many worlds version of quantum immortality is real, you wouldn't even have a choice in the matter because you could take risks. But subjectively, we know that you're not going to do that because the versions of you that did that will eventually disappear and you will have no choice but to be funneled into this – the safe, stagnant existence.
Spacing Guild wins again.
So we should definitely talk about problems and criticisms of this idea. There are a lot of reasons to think that this might not be the case. So as we said earlier, but we just want to stress again, we are not advocating the idea that you are immortal according to the laws of quantum mechanics.
Correct. We cannot be any more clear on that point.
And even some of the original authors of this experiment, they've come to doubt it. Like Max Tegmark, the MIT physicist we've been talking about, he proposed quantum suicide and quantum immortality as thought experiments, but he acknowledges the tenuous nature of the premises under them and actually doubts it could be a reality based on plenty of concerns he has. Like one problem is that Tegmark has these caveats to the quantum suicide experiment and says that it would only even work in theory if – the determination of whether the machine kills you is truly quantum, as in depending on a quantum particle in superposition. It wouldn't necessarily work if you were letting it depend on, say, a coin flip, which could be purely deterministic.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the machine must be guaranteed to kill you on the kill setting. It couldn't have a possibility of just injuring you. Also, it would need to, as we mentioned earlier, if it does kill you, it would have to do so instantly, not gradually, because you can't have the – you can't have a chance that it takes you a while to die after the quantum coin toss and you're just sitting there waiting to find out what happens because then your consciousness could get routed into that universe.
So just from like a design standpoint, it sounds extremely difficult, if not impossible, to create the right kind of technology. You certainly could make it in your garage,
right?
Because it would need to depend on the quantum. It would need to never fail. Like it could absolutely, if it could malfunction, that would destroy the whole experiment, right?
It at least should have a very, very small chance of malfunctioning.
Okay.
Now, in criticism of the general idea of quantum immortality extending beyond the quantum suicide experiment itself, but just like does this apply to reality as a whole? Should we all expect to subjectively live forever? Even though Tegmark does seem to subscribe to the many worlds interpretation, Tegmark says that most accidents and common causes of death do not satisfy all three of these criteria. And plus, there's a bigger problem about Tegmark talks about the fact that most life and death scenarios don't actually break down into a clear life or death binary where you've got continued consciousness on the one hand and non-continued consciousness on the other. But he says, you know, it seems to be that there is a gradual reduction of consciousness as one progresses toward death. And if this is the case, then you could have the assumptions of this violated, right? If you can gradually ratchet down your level of consciousness.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, I don't sit around fearing the termination of my consciousness. I fear all the things leading up to it,
yeah,
and surrounding it, you know, all the consolation prizes.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, especially on this view, because if you take the view that there's literally nothing after death, there's nothing to fear there.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
But that also brings up another big problem, is that we don't actually know exactly what happens to consciousness at the time of death. And I'm not saying that you have to propose, you know, religious type answers about souls and afterlife and stuff like that. Obviously, some people believe in things like that. But even if you don't believe in anything spiritual, supernatural, anything like that, there are still things that could happen with the subjective phenomena of consciousness other than just it blips out of existence, right?
Yeah, like you come back as a goat.
or there could be, I mean, if consciousness is some kind of process or substance, there's perhaps some way in which it lingers or winds down slowly after death, or is reduced to some kind of other, liminal or peripheral state after death. I mean, we just don't really know what happens. There's no evidence about what exactly happens there. Also, to be honest, we don't actually really know, if we're going to pick nits, I don't know what it means to survive from one moment to the next as a being experiencing consciousness, except that we all generally tend to be under the impression that this is happening to us. I'm under the impression that I'm surviving. But if we live in a universe where constantly we're branching off into different branches, you know, out of a quantum superposition and different timelines, how does the baton get passed? Does that make any sense?
Like, yeah, no. I mean, this gets down to the basic navel-gazing that we've engaged in before regarding the present moment. Mm-hmm. Am I now who I was a minute ago? Am I now who I will be a minute from now?
Yeah.
I mean, when you start really focusing in on that, it starts feeling disjointed, perhaps disjointed in a way that could match up with this idea of branching realities.
Yeah. How does the now you pass the token of subjective experience to the you of one moment in the future?
Yeah. And what happens when the baton is dropped, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, and again, I'm not sure that presents a problem. I just say that's something that we're not certain we've really worked out yet, right? Right? What does it mean for experience to exist across time, especially if that experience is branching into clones or copies of itself?
Yeah. Yeah. When you start actually lining it up with the human experience, things are a little less certain. It's often easier to line it up with created things, mm-hmm, like looking at chapters in a book or levels in a video game.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't bring that up to say that it like disproves the validity of the quantum suicide or quantum immortality thought experiments, but I just want to suggest that the periphery assumptions underlying these thought experiments are not as simple and straightforward as they seem, not even the physics assumptions, but just the assumptions about death and life and consciousness and survival. As even more doubt to throw on here, Max Tegmark himself explains that he later came to doubt the validity of his own quantum suicide experiment, but for totally different reasons. He came to doubt the validity based on doubts about the concept of infinity as applied to physics, which he is in some sense skeptical about, though he admits to being in the minority of physicists on this point.
Now, I mentioned video games earlier, and that's because I wanted to talk just a little bit about save scumming.
What does that mean?
So I was familiar with save scumming from playing a fair amount of XCOM and XCOM 2, the most recent incarnations of the XCOM video game.
I've never played these, so you got to explain to me.
So XCOM is basically it's aliens have invaded or are invading, and you have to fight them using a squad of soldiers.
Okay.
And if you're playing just kind of like the vanilla version of the game, then each time you start playing, you get a random bunch of recruits, and they level up as you play. And then in each tactical mission, you can lose the various men and women in your service. And the ones that survive, they level up and get stronger, and you proceed through the game in an attempt to save the world, to outlast the doom counter, and win the game.
Okay.
Now, the real hardcore fans like to play an Iron Man version of this. So this is where you have only one save file,
And no matter what happens on a given mission, you just keep going. You just lost your best guy due to some like freak accident or a terrible shot or a terrible choice on your part. Too bad. You just have to keep playing the game until you either reach the point where you cannot win, where the doom counter catches up with you, or you just get to the final encounter and you're not strong enough to beat it.
Okay.
But you can also do what is called save scumming. And this is more in line, I think, with the way a lot of people have played video games in the past, you know, especially ones where you get to save as often as you want and as many times as you want. And in doing this, you simply go back to a previous save file every time something bad happens.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So it's kind of – yeah, it's kind of like the saving function serves as like a place where you can save the timeline of the world before it branched off into its different mini worlds.
Yeah. So it's like, oh, I just lost my best dude by having them look around this corner. I'll go back to a previous save game and I'll have him look around the other corner instead.
Yeah. Going between the different save files is like getting a way to navigate the mini worlds from above.
Yeah. And it leads to a certain kind of quantum immortality.
Yeah. I mean, even in a normal game, not like with the one you're describing, you can't get to the final boss, say, in a version of the game where you died on the first level. Like you know, and that's all you did. You can't keep going on. You have to use a version where you survived and progressed.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to imply that one way is better than the other when you're playing a video game. My approach is play the video game however makes you happy. You know, Richard K. Morgan also got into this a little bit in Altered Carbon, because you have these super rich Methuselahs, they call them, the meths, who put their consciousness in different bodies, different sleeves, as they call them. And you have characters who will end up essentially save scumming with their body. Something happens that either got them killed or drives them mad or makes them feel, you know, too much guilt. Well, then they just revert to a previous save file, a previous version of their own consciousness, and they keep going.
I mean, I wonder if some people – I wonder about psychological effects of video games that could put you in that state of mind without the ability to physically do what you're describing with the sleeves and the bodies. I mean, is somebody who plays a whole lot of video games with save files conditioning themselves to act like that is the way the world works, even though it is not the way the world works?
Now, that's an interesting question. I mean, we've certainly discussed on the show how things like language, the sequential aspects of language might impact our experience of reality. So, yeah, why not? Maybe there's a book out there, The Mario and the Goddess.
To get serious, I do think one thing that we should say before the end is we've taken pains to try to highlight all of the reasons that you can't just trust that the quantum immortality thing is real, that the quantum suicide experiment would actually work. There are a lot of reasons to doubt it. But we just want to emphasize again, for serious reasons, that the idea of quantum immortality is highly speculative and relies on a lot of assumptions which could be wrong. Maybe the mini worlds interpretation is wrong. Even if the mini worlds interpretation is correct, many of the assumptions underlying the experiment and how consciousness and survival and death and branching works could be wrong. So we should acknowledge that if somebody puts too much confidence in this view of the world, it could actually be dangerous. And I read a tragic story. In 1996, Hugh Everett's daughter, Elizabeth, actually did commit suicide, and she reportedly left a note saying that she planned to join her father in another universe. I don't know if that means her suicide was motivated by a belief in many worlds' immortality. It might not have been, but in any case, quantum immortality wouldn't work like that. But it seems to me that it's worth clarifying that even though this is an interesting thought experiment, it's by no means a good reason to attempt suicide or to throw caution to the wind and count on many worlds consciousness funneling to save you. Your life is valuable how it is. Pursue it how it is.
Yeah, and we'd like to remind you that if you are troubled by suicidal thoughts, you are not alone. A sympathetic ear is only a phone call away. In the United States, consider calling the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255 and visit suicidepreventionlifeline.org for additional resources tailored toward general and specific needs, such as those of youth, disaster survivors, Native Americans, veterans, loss survivors, LGBTQ, and attempt survivors. And you'll You'll also find a list of international suicide hotlines at suicide.org.
If you're actually thinking about it, get in contact. It matters.
All right, that's the episode, and we'll be back for more in the future. But in the meantime, you can check out all past episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind at stufftoblowyourmind.com. You'll also find links out to our various social media accounts there.
Huge thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly by email and let us know feedback on this episode or any other, or just to say hi, get in touch, let us know what you like about the show, maybe suggest a topic for the future, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.